everybody, welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Android, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, we would love it. If you could spread the word, share, like, subscribe, give us some feedback, give us some stars, tell us what you think. As you know, this podcast is all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music business, talking to people about, hey, how did they get their music job? How did they get to the job that they're at today? What decisions did they make? What obstacles did they face? What advice do they have to share with the rest of us? Also for independent artists, how do we navigate this new music landscape today? So just a lot of really good wisdom. All the episodes are on the website, musicjobspodcast.com. So if you are looking for a specific career or a specific interview, you can just use the search bar and go on back and listen to previous episodes. So last episode, I had the immense, wonderful pleasure of speaking with J. Michael Dolan. He is an accomplished author. He's a consultant to some very high-profile people in the entertainment industry. He is an avid blogger, and he is the founder of Music Connection Magazine, the magazine Bible for the hardworking musician. And we just had a really wonderful talk all about, you know, his stepping stones for his career and also just about being of service in the new music industry. It was a very inspiring and I'd say like a very spiritual conversation, very moving. And I do hope that if you didn't get a chance to listen to it, that you will at some point go on back and listen to that episode. My next guest is no exception to being very inspiring and very empowering. Astrid Baumgartner is all about innovation and entrepreneurship. She is a talented pianist. She is a seasoned lawyer from New York. She is a certified professional coach specializing in career success and leadership development. And she works with new music composers as coordinator of career strategies and lecturer of careers in music at the prestigious Yale School of Music. She's also working on a book about creatives and entrepreneurship. So again, this is going to be one of these interviews you are not going to want to miss, whether you are an independent artist, whether you are a new music composer, whether you're just a creative. There's just so many great nuggets of wisdom in this interview. So before we start, I asked Astrid to share one of her favorite pieces of music, and she suggested Steve Reich's Mallet Quartet, the first movement, Fast, performed by So Percussion. So here it is. For joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Oh, it's a pleasure, El Ariel. I'm delighted to be able to be here and share with the vast music public out there how one goes about creating success in this fascinating time of ours.
Yes, and I'm thrilled that you're here on the West Coast.
Yes,
in sunny SoCal. Yeah.
You bet.
Great. Okay, well, I always like to start with my guests just talking about their first exposure to music. Like, what are kind of your first memories of music as a child?
That is such a great question. And the answer to that question for me is there was never a time in my life when music was not a part. Because my dad was a phenomenal pianist, and he was actually an amateur, but had had the opportunity to go to conservatory, and his father wouldn't let him go. Just a quick story, my parents are Polish immigrants, so my dad grew up in Poland, and of course, being a Pole, he loved Chopin, and when he was 16, he won a scholarship to the Paris Conservatory, but his father said, that's not a practical career. Mm. You have to become a chemist. But his entire life, he played the piano, and my dad and my mom both escaped, you know, from very difficult circumstances after World War II and came here. And my dad's first job was as a scientist, but also he gave piano lessons. So when I was born, shortly after my parents arrived in the U.S., literally, I probably came home from the hospital and was hearing Chopin at age 4 days.
That's beautiful.
And so music has been with me all my life. My father was my first piano teacher. I think I started lessons when I was 4 or 5, and it's been a very important part of my life ever since then.
That's great. Now, what about your own sort of musical pursuit? Did you feel intimidated at all?
So it's very interesting. No, I love music. And as I said, it was very easy to study with my father. And I'm an oldest child. I have a younger sister. And oldest children, this is probably a gross exaggeration, tend to be very dutiful and responsible. So my dad, as the piano teacher, I did what he told me. And, you know, I had a lot of talent, as I was told. And so I took lessons up until the time I went to college. I then switched. At a certain point, you know, daddy was a little too easy of a target when there was a lot of homework. So my parents switched me to a phenomenal teacher in our local town. I grew up in New Jersey. And this woman was French, and she studied with Courtauld. So it was quite an incredible lineage of piano teachers. And she wanted me to go to Juilliard, and I said, you know, I'm never going to be Arthur Rubinstein, so forget it. That was a little bit of my mentality. I'll talk more about mindset in a minute. But I continued to play piano through college, and then I went to law school, and that's when I stopped playing the piano. But once I began my legal career, I missed the piano so much that I went out and bought a tiny little piano. I lived in New York City in a tiny little apartment, and I had a piano that was just big enough to fit in our entrance hallway. And I remember the first piece I picked up after that was Bach's Italian Concerto. I just remember being so happy that I was back to piano, and it's been with me ever since.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you mentioned the mindset that you felt, because that was kind of what I was wondering too. And I also studied classical piano, and I felt that there was kind of this huge gap, you know, from practicing and playing and enjoying it as a child and a teen, but to actually pursue it into college and as possibly a career just seemed too overwhelming. And I'm wondering if you can kind of expand on that.
Well, I'll have to say I agree with you on that, Ariel, and it is why I decided not to even apply to Juilliard, because it felt very intimidating. You know, my parents were in a circle of musicians. They had lots of musical friends. They actually had a friend who made his Carnegie Hall debut. I remember when I was 8 going to Carnegie Hall and seeing my parents' friend up there on the big stage. So it really did feel too big. And I definitely came from the school of perfectionism. Yeah, I had immigrant parents, and I'm sure a lot of you immigrants out there, no matter what your nationality, I've found this to be a constant. Immigrant parents want their kids to succeed. They come to America. The message is, we're in America, the land of greatness. You need a good education. Work hard. You'll be a success. And you have to be the best at everything. So that was a lot of pressure on me. And that definitely applied to my piano playing, to the point that I really didn't even want to play for many years. I did, but it felt like a huge struggle. And what happened was, in my adult years, so when I had kids, I had 2 children, a son and a daughter, and my kids both took piano, and I was playing along and feeling totally intimidated. And five of us got together, and we did The Artist's Way. Which was pretty amazing. So one of my friends was a photographer, one made jewelry, one was an artist, one was a writer, and then I was the musician. And so we were all locked creatives, and we followed that program, and it was pretty extraordinary, because what I discovered a lot of things through there. I really got in touch with that voice of the inner critic, and how, you know, it just stops you and how it prevents you from enjoying your life, right? So through that program and through the support of my phenomenal friends, we just all helped each other get over the blocks. And I remember there was a great quote in that book: in order to make good art, you first have to make bad art. And I thought, that's amazing, because the message I got was, from the minute you sit down to the piano, it has to be perfect, and you have to work towards perfection. So that was one huge lesson for me. Another big lesson was when I became trained as a coach. I went through a pretty rigorous coach training program, and we read all kinds of really interesting books about how to master your best life. And again, the whole notion was, it's a journey, and enjoy the journey. And the outcome is just a byproduct of being your best self. So I thought, this is pretty great. Interestingly, in my coach school, we had to do a presentation, and mine was on coaching creative success, which is what my new book is going to be about. So I'm really excited about that. But the third really important piece of this puzzle is reading the work of Dr. Carol Dweck, who is a professor at Stanford, mm-hmm. and she has done research for years on the mindset of talented people. And it started in early childhood education, but she noticed that little children, some of them were just really excited about learning, and if they made a mistake, that was okay because they learned from it. And other kids, the minute they hit something hard, they would stop because it was too hard and they didn't want to make a mistake. So she began studying this, and she came up with these two wonderful notions, one called the growth mindset as opposed to the fixed mindset. So growth mindset is where you view your talent and your intelligence as the starting point, but that success is really dependent upon your ability to work hard with smart strategies and being willing to take risks and quote-unquote fail as long as you learn from those failures and learn how to be better the next time. Fixed mindset says, I have a fixed amount of talent and intelligence, and that means I have to protect my talent and intelligence. And if I make a mistake, it means that maybe I'm not as talented or as intelligent as I think I am. And this applies to a lot of child prodigies, right? Musicians, athletes, you know, kids who are just great at baseball or skating or piano or, you know, writing songs. And then they learn or they fear that they can't make a mistake, right? So that's that whole perfectionism. And as I reflected back on my life, I realized, whoa, I spent a lot of years in that fixed mindset mentality. And the beauty of Carol Dweck's program is that you can learn how to manage that fixed mindset.
Hmm.
And I have noticed, you know, since I teach at Yale and I have a coaching business where I work with highly successful musicians in and around the country, this really resonates. So I remember the first time I read Mindset, and I can't remember why I picked it up, but as a coach and as a very curious person, I read a lot, and I read this and I went, I have to take this to my classroom. So I guess it was the third year I taught at Yale, I introduced this, and the student said to me, whoa, we had no idea that we had a choice, that we don't have to stay locked in this perfectionistic, you know, stance of ours. And so I included that as part of my curriculum. I teach this class on entrepreneurship at Yale at the School of Music with these incredibly talented, intelligent students. And the results were just pretty spectacular. So every semester I introduce that. And after a while, it was pretty interesting. I read a blog on my website, and I was writing about this growth mindset stuff, and I sort of decided that I was going to talk to Dr. Carol Dweck. So I wrote to her, I sent her my blog post, and she responded, and we had a phone conversation where she was really, really delighted to see me apply this to the world of music and encouraged me to keep going with it. So it was, that was very exciting, because I will tell you that my fixed mindset said, why would Carol Dweck talk to me, right? And then my growth mindset said, hey, let me just try, you know? And it was great because I really learned a lot from her and really appreciated her support. So that has become a linchpin of what I do as a coach and as a teacher, is teach these highly skilled, highly trained, highly intelligent musicians that it's okay to take risks and quote unquote fail. You have to know when to fail. That's going to be one of my next blog posts. Because you're right, on stage, whether you're a pop star, an opera singer, or a violinist, you want to put your best foot out there for the public. But if you relax into it and don't worry about being perfect, but rather being excellent, inspiring, passionate, you know, connecting, whatever it is, you're going to be a lot stronger as a performer.
Mm-hmm. That's so great. And that's such an essential resource. I'm really, really thrilled that you shared that. I think our listeners are going to get so much out of it. I just want to back up a little bit and hear about, because I think it would be very inspiring and intriguing for our listeners to hear about, how did you go from law school and becoming a lawyer to this profession? How did all that come about?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I love my story, because my story, I think, can inspire a lot of people. So we need to back up to me as a little kid playing the piano. So passion for music from day one of my life, or maybe day four. The other thing I did was we spoke a lot of languages in my household, including French. My mom introduced me to French when I was six, and that was my major in college. So those are kind of the strands. That's what I thought I was going to be in life, as a French professor. And I went junior year abroad in college to Paris and studied at the Sorbonne and realized I want a job where I'm interacting with the world and making it a better place. And being a French professor just didn't seem to be the right thing. So I decided to go to law school. I decided to go to law school because I saw a poster of a woman in a pantsuit and it said, go to law school. And I said, I want to be like her.
That's amazing.
It's pretty funny. And I remember when it happened, I was on the subway in New York City on the Lexington Avenue line. And literally as we passed Bloomingdale's on the 59th Street stop, I saw that poster. And it was like a sign. That's very funny. So I went to law school with this notion that I was going to go change the world and be one of those women in society doing great things. Mm-hmm. And went to law school and I really never loved it. Yeah, that was kind of hard. I mean, I got married when I was in law school to the same wonderful man to whom I'm married today, 44 years, yay. And he's a lawyer, and he, you know, it was just such a contrast. And he would sort of pop out of bed every day to go to work, and I would say, okay, it's time to go to work. So we then had our two kids, and I did switch at some point. I went from being a lawyer in New York law firms to a French law firm, working part-time, raised my kids, so that was kind of cool. But while I was working, as I said, it was a part-time job. And once my children were in junior high school, I was working almost full-time, but I had a little spare time. And I decided to volunteer for some arts organizations and discovered that I was having a really good time with people who cared about the arts. And, you know, it involved raising money, doing strategic planning, all kinds of things that I wasn't doing in law, and I was much happier doing that. And when my son was about to be a senior, I think in high school, is when I decided to make a switch, and I went from my French law firm in New York, by the way, I never left New York, to I became the deputy executive director of the French Institute d'Alliance Française of New York. So that was kind of cool. I made a lateral move. And the reason I mentioned this French situation is that these are childhood passions. And so all of you out there, tap into what you love doing as a little kid. Because when you're a little kid, you don't have filters. You don't have people telling you, do this, don't do this. You're just doing what you love. So if you found yourself, you know, enacting plays in your basement or writing poems or singing songs for your family, remember that childhood passion, that's telling you something, right? Mm-hmm. So there I was, you know, and I was pretty happy going to the French Institute d'Alliance Française. Again, it was an opportunity for me to use my French after I'd been at a French law firm. Oh, yeah, did I mention that? That was one of my things that I did. Moving from U.S. law to French law to French, you know, French nonprofit arts organization. I did that for 3 years, and then I left. I was actually downsized. So I've been through all aspects of the job market, right? Hiring, firing, being on the receiving end of having to be downsized. And I met a guy through a job search, and we formed a company together. So that was my first experience of running a business. It was a consulting business to nonprofit organizations, visual arts and performing arts. And we did that for a year. Learned how to run a business. We parted amicably. And then I kind of wandered around. I was studying at Juilliard because I wanted to go back to piano. I was volunteering a lot. I kind of didn't know what to do. And then this is the sad part of my story, which is I had a very serious health crisis that kind of took me out for quite some time because I was in the hospital in a coma.
Oh, wow.
And it was an interesting, yeah, it was very bad. I really did come very close to death and made it and woke up on my birthday.
Whoa.
And yeah, and there I was in the ICU with a zillion tubes going out of my body. And my mom showed up at the hospital with a big birthday cake, obviously not for me, but she said, happy birthday. I went, it's my birthday. I came back for a reason.
Wow.
And through the next year, I had to undergo quite a bit of surgery. I mean, it was really pretty serious. And after one of my surgeries, I was lying on my couch recovering, and I heard a voice that said, Astrid, you need to get up off that couch and help people through their life transitions. So that was amazing. I spoke to a very dear friend on the phone. I said, boy, I just heard this little voice. What's that about? She said, oh, that's easy. She said, that's life coaching. So I immediately plunged into an investigation of what's life coaching and who are life coaches and what do they do and how do you become one? And it sounded really great. And that's how I decided to become a coach. And I did that. And in my coaching school, we had not only learned the skills of how to become a really good coach, but also business development and thinking about how do you want to apply this, you know, this new skill set. And that was where I realized that I wanted to work with musicians. One night, and this is a really important story, we had classes every week which we phoned into. So you'd dial your little phone and there would be a class for all of the coaching students. And one night there was a fellow presenting the class. He said, "Hi, my name is Jim. I'm a coach, a lawyer, and a talent agent. And I teach at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York." And literally, when I heard that, a little light bulb went off my head and I said, "I want to teach." And I wrote in my journal, and I journal, and that's another thing I recommend to everybody. Journaling, that was another thing I got out of doing the Artist Way. So I wrote down, in 5 years, I want to be on the faculty of a conservatory like Juilliard, parentheses, or maybe even Yale.
You wrote that?
I did. That was in 2008.
That's amazing.
I tell this story because I'm a big believer in writing down your goals. Mm-hmm. And I define a goal as something you want to achieve within a time period. So there I was in my 5 years. So I gave myself to 2013, right? So here it is, 2008. I woke up the next day. I went, okay, I'm on a program. I have 5 years to achieve this goal. And I immediately called up. I have a lot of friends who teach at Juilliard. And I said, so I'm here to coach. I want to coach creative people and coach musicians. And I'd love to come to your class. And just I volunteered to go into their classes and do a class on coaching creative success. And my friends obliged. And it was great. And then they introduced me to the head of career office at Juilliard. And I began a whole series of what they call lunch and learns. All you Juilliard people out there, I'm sure you remember those, where, you know, you'd come in at lunch hour and do a 45-minute presentation. I did a whole slew of those throughout the year. And then by the end of that sort of school year, I had done a lot of these coaching, you know, presentations and workshops at Juilliard. And I knew the people at Yale because we have a home in Northwest Connecticut near Norfolk, Connecticut, which is where the Yale Summer Music School is. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned to the director that I had been doing all this work at Juilliard and I would love to come to Yale to do some career workshops. He said, "Your timing is excellent because we don't have anybody doing career stuff and we realize we need somebody. So why don't you come to Norfolk and do two workshops there and do two at Yale?" Which I did the following year, and was sort of love at first sight. Like, I walked into the room, and I will share that I was quite intimidated. You know, here it is, Yale, right? This sort of big deal thing. And the students were so wonderful, and I did this series of workshops with them, and it was just magical because they were sharing really from their heart, and we just had such an amazing time. And at the end of the second one, they said to me, "Well, we've been sharing our hearts out with you. What is your dream?" I said, "Well, it's very simple. I want to come here and teach and run your program." And they all went to the dean and said, "You should hire her."
Aww.
So that was pretty cool. So let's fast forward 6 months. So I've just done a bunch at Yale and several of these workshops at Norfolk. And at the end of the summer, the director of the program called me and said, "Let's have lunch." And at lunch, he asked me what I wanted for my relationship with Yale. And I said, "Yeah, I want to come and create the class and run the program and create your program." And he said, "Well, we've just changed our curriculum and we now want to have more on the career area and we'd love for you to come do it." So that's how I did it. And it was 2011, through 2 years ahead of schedule. So I have been on the faculty at Yale. I was there as a guest lecturer in 2010. And that's when I did those wonderful workshops. And then in 2011, I joined the faculty and assumed an administrative role to be the head of the Office of Career Strategies. And I've been doing that ever since. And as a parallel to that, I also have my own coaching company where I work with individually with artists and musicians in around New York City. But also I coach by FaceTime and Skype. So I have people all over the country. I blog and guest lecture, and now I'm writing my book. So it's all amazing. And I guess my bottom line is have a dream and then go for it, right? It can be scary, but the only way to achieve those dreams is to break it down and take actions. You know, like I did that journaling exercise and my first action was got to call the people at Juilliard and one workshop at a time, and one workshop leads to another, and three workshops might lead to another engagement. And that is how I created my entire business.
That's so great. I love it.
Thank you.
I love
Thank
this you. Whole trajectory. It's just amazing. What I want to ask you about is new music, classical music. I mean, what I think is so great, and this is what I love when my guests share about this, is that you saw an audience that was underserved, because clearly yes. at Juilliard and Yale, they were hungry for this. They needed this. They needed this curriculum. They needed you. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that, because I think, unfortunately, you know, with all types of music, there always seems to be sort of a very narrow playing field. And, you know, with classical and new music, there's this kind of idea too of like, well, you know, that's kind of outdated. And I think it's so essential to see it as a business and an art form that definitely has an audience. And how do you connect the two? Right.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm wondering if you can just talk more about that.
Sure. So first of all, one of the things that I have noticed over the years is that my students at Yale do not like being defined as classical musicians. Mm-hmm. They say we are well-trained musicians.
Yep.
We don't want to be boxed into the classical box. So,
yep.
And they also don't like the crossover label. They all say, we just want to make good music with good people. So I have a lot of students who do jazz, who incorporate electronics, who write music with all kinds of different influences, and they just want to do their thing and make great music. That's mm-hmm. one very important strain. The second very important strain is that my students want to perform for their peers. Yeah, which is really pretty cool. The class I teach at Yale, I've taught a number of different classes, but there's always a project component. My latest class is called Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Collaboration, and it's about how to create something new, you know, innovate for today's audiences. And I always have a project of let's create an event for our peers. So they don't even want to call it a concert, right? So every year there's some new variation. And one year there were these two students who literally created an event that paired different classical music or pieces of music with drinks, because one of the guys who was a tuba player was a really good mixologist.
That's so great.
That was cool. They did about six of those. I mean, the first concert was such a success that they then did a whole bunch more. So that was really fun. This year they did a beautiful house concert with video projections. And again, in a very beautiful and small intimate space where literally one of the audience members who was in my class said, I could have turned the pages for the violin, right? I mean, they were just, the audience was right there with the musicians and the audience participated. They were drones. They sang along, you know, so to make it fun, to make it relevant, to make it community oriented, because I think that's one of the strains now with social media. It's so easy to just check out and never talk to a live human. And the beauty of music, no matter what kind of music you're making, is that it should be a community experience where people come together to experience the magic of music, right? Mm-hmm. So my students and today's musicians that I've noticed are really thinking about how do we get our public in there? How do we make our music relevant? How do we touch hearts? How do we get across the message that coming together and experiencing music is a really good thing? And so, you know, you're right. I saw an underserved audience. I would say that the 20, 30-somethings is an underserved audience because, you know, let's face it, not having music education in the schools has raised a generation of people who really don't know what music is. So there's an opportunity here to get people to understand that music really matters. And let's face it, there's music everywhere. You know, you walk down the street and people have their earbuds in and they're listening to music, and you go to Starbucks and people are listening to music, and you know, pretty much everywhere you go, there's music. So it's not that music is not important. It's just, I think these labels have gotten in our way. And I think we need to just message very differently that, hey, this is something that you're going to love, you know? and not to preach. You know, I think, you know, you have a very wide pop music audience, but the classical music audience can be pretty, is seen as very elite. And again, that's something that my students want to get rid of, that elitist label. I'll tell you a story about the elitism of classical music. One of my friends is the president of the League of American Orchestras, which is the big umbrella group for all orchestras in the U.S., mm-hmm. and every year they have a conference. So one year the conference was in Dallas, and my friend took a cab, you know, flew to Dallas from New York and got in a cab, and there was a gentleman there, this cab driver, was listening to Beethoven. And so my friend said, "Wow, this is so great. Do you like classical music?" And the fellow said, "I love it. I listen to it all day long while I'm riding, you know, driving people around, and I listen to it at home." And my friend said, "Well, you should come to some concert." And the gentleman, the taxi driver, said, "You know, I can't afford to." And mm-hmm. Jesse said, "Really? You know, there's rush pricing. There's all kinds of ways to get tickets to the Dallas Symphony that are not expensive." And the fellow said, "You know, I can't afford to buy a tux."
Aww.
This fellow thought you had to, that audience members had to wear tuxedos, you know. So, boy, oh boy, there's a lot of disinformation out there. And this is what my students are trying to do, to just say, "Hey, we want to get together to share music, good music, inspiring music, fun music, beautiful music, sad music, just music."
Brilliant. And I'm wondering also if you touched on, you know, social media, and I'm wondering also, you know, with, it is such a wild west right now, I think, the music totally. Landscape, and there's all these platforms, video games, and, you know, content providers are just, you know, that need soundtracks and sure. all these things that are being generated. And I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about that a little bit, and how, you know, it takes all types of music to feed the beast, so to speak, to feed
for sure.
all these demands for music of all kinds.
No, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, you know, Yale has a really great composition department, and a lot of our students are writing for video music, video game music. That's a big market. So mm-hmm. that's, you know, and so every time a market changes, right, there are old things that die and new opportunities that crop up. And I agree with you that the video games and the soundtracks are definitely opportunities for people to create music. And, I, you know, it's interesting because I have a client who's a really wonderful new music performer, and she decided she also wanted to compose. So she writes soundtracks. That's another one of her revenue streams now. She figured out how to compose on, I guess it's... you know, one of the programs, I can't remember which one she used, but she now gets hired to write for commercials, you know? So that's, and composers I know will now sort of divide up their work, you know, composing for art, composing for ads, for film, for video. That's definitely a revenue stream, which is great. You know, what I like to think about is you can analogize the music world to a bakery, right? So, yeah, that traditionally, classical music has viewed itself as a pie, and that pie is limited, and, you know, there are only so many slivers of the pie that we can cut up and distribute. And I like to think of new music as generating a new bakery, where we have lots of different pies. And I'm the board chair of a really wonderful organization called So Percussion. So these are four fellows who went to Yale and decided that the world needed a percussion quartet, which did not exist in the U.S. There was one in Canada. And everyone told them, "This is really stupid. Nobody's going to listen to a percussion quartet," except for their percussion teacher and a few other kind of brave new souls who said, "Yeah, go for it. If it doesn't exist, it either means it's the world's worst idea or the world's greatest idea that no one's come up with." And they've been doing this now since, I think, 2004, so a while. And not only do they successfully tour, record, and perform, but they're now the ensemble in residence at Princeton, where they teach, where they run ensembles, and they give lots of concerts. And one of the members of So Percussion teaches steel drum. And Princeton doesn't even have a performance major, but 20 kids have signed up for this class, and he has a waiting list of 35 kids at Princeton who want to take steel drum. So that's my point, you know, and their philosophy is very much that the music world has an infinite capacity, And I love that. That's one of the reasons that I joined their board and became the chair, because it's so collaborative in nature. They're always looking for people. They commission work. They collaborate with lots of different artists. They teach. Oh, yeah, that's right. They have a summer program called Soul Percussion Summer Institute. So it's a very generous way of looking at the music space. And I see a lot of artists who embody that sort of collaborative nature. And I really love that, because music can be so dog-eat-dog, you know, the classical music world. You know, auditioning for an orchestra job where 200 people will show up for a third flute position, you know, mm-hmm. in Memphis. And, you know, instead, like, okay, let those people try to audition, but let's maybe create something new that people want. And what I love about the Soul Percussion audience is that it does attract traditional chamber music lovers as well as people who like really, you know, out there music. It's yep. kind of neat to see the audience.
Yep. And I actually, you know, and this is again because of the work that you're doing, and I hope that we can spread the message. You know, new music is really more akin to sort of the tech world. Pop yes. music, mainstream music is actually pretty archaic. You know, it's almost sure. the reverse of what people think. Like, oh, classical yes. new music is like, no, actually pop music, mainstream music is, they're pretty limited. You know, what yes. what's going to be acceptable, what's going to move the needle, what's going to be acceptable to the charts, et cetera. Whereas in new music, there's exactly. so much fluidity. And I think there's right. much more ability to innovate, to bring in more global aspects, right?
Yes.
To try, you know, it's almost like you said, the bakery thing, like making a cake with yeah. all these crazy ingredients versus,
correct.
You know, okay, drum, bass, guitar, you know, that's it. That's mm-hmm. all we can do. So yeah. I'm wondering if you can yep. just expand on that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, lots of possibilities, right? First of all, within music, right? Collaborating. So I always encourage students to the performers to go find a composer and befriend a composer, because you can become that composer's muse, right? Mm-hmm. And have music written for you, especially for some of the more oddball instruments, like, you know, piano. We, as a pianist, you know, we have amazing repertoire. Violin, amazing repertoire. French horn, not so much. Tuba, almost nothing, you know? So seriously, I see all kinds of kids, you know, the brass students at Yale teaming up with the composers to get a trombone quartet written, you know, that yep. sort of thing. So that's one way of expanding the pie, literally, and expanding the bakery. Another thing that I see as a big trend now is collaboration among different arts genres, right?
Yep.
So finding a video artist, right? Mm-hmm. Getting a stage director and including some actors in your performance. I've seen that done very, very successfully. Collaborating with poets, getting a poet or a novelist to write you a text and set that to music. That's old, but, you know, in a new genre, that can be very, very interesting. So again, to reach out and using visual art as a part of music, I think, you know, we're living in a very visual culture, and I think that helps a lot. I mean, for example, you know, the concert that these students of mine did last semester where they had video projections, that you're seeing more and more of. And, you know, one of the cool things about Yale is that we have School of Drama, School of Art, School of Music. And while the schedules are pretty hard to, you know, line up, I have very adventurous students who have reached out to students in the art school and in the drama school to collaborate with them. And they've done some really, really interesting work. And I see that in New York a lot, that there's much more of this interdisciplinary collaboration, which I love to see. I was an interdisciplinary major myself because I was a French and Spanish Romance language major. So I'm a big believer that the more you can find people who are in sync with you outside your specific little niche,
yes, exactly.
it brings in different audiences, and it also enlarges the creative conversation, which I think is very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you reminded me with the tuba, you know, it sure. Mexican banda music, right?
Sure.
They, you know, they use a lot of tuba. So it's
yes,
like,
exactly.
that's something that I'm sure, you know, players and composers are starting to incorporate. And again, it's sort of like the language barriers and the country barriers are kind of starting to fall away because, again, with social media and this sort of ability to really connect with anyone globally, now you can start seeing
yes.
sort of merging of these different types of music, right?
Very much so, yeah. I'm working with a trumpet player now, and he does routinely Baroque, Latin jazz, and classical.
I love it.
Which is incredible. Yeah. And I mean, and that takes a certain skill set because there are different techniques and different worlds, but he's very excited about doing that. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm helping him with, is try to, you know, make that sustainable for him.
That's so great. It's so inspiring. And it's really exciting too, to hear about sort of what's coming out of these schools and these curriculums. Yeah. So I'm really thrilled. And I'm wondering if we can lastly just talk a little bit more about your book and,
sure.
You know, the purpose of your book and exactly what you're trying to share about. I'd love to hear more about it.
Absolutely. Sure. So I've been writing a blog, I think, since 2010. And my blog is pitched to creative people to help them, you know, to help them figure out how to create what I call authentic success. So that's kind of my starting point. I work with creative people because I love the notion that creative people want to make something new and make something better, and that they're literally on this lifelong journey of exploration of how they can get their creative ideas out there. And ultimately, when you probe creative people, they're doing it to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. They may not know this. And I ask that question. I have a whole class on creating a life purpose, you know, figuring out your life purpose, which is, you know, why am I on this planet? How can I apply my talents, strengths, and passions to serve a particular public and make the world a better place? And if you ask people why they make music, the first answer is because it's pretty, because it's beautiful, because it's meaningful. Well, what's meaningful about it? Well, I can connect communities, I can share. And you start probing, and it really is, I want to connect with audiences to inspire them, to make them happier, to make them process their emotions, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I think in our world today, having a purpose is pretty critical, because our world, let's face it, not such a happy place these days. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the things about being a creative artist, is that it's sort of an affirmation that I want to do something to make this world a better place. So that's why I'm so passionate about helping creative people. And I want creative people to be able to put their work out there and be successful, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm all about how to create success, and success is however you define it. And it has to be authentic success. In other words, I think creative people show who they are through their art. And therefore, you have to know who you are. So there's a whole examination of what are your values, what are your passions, what are your strengths, having to know that and going on that creative inquiry. And then it's a coaching book. So I'm a coach, and coaches ask probing questions to help you tap into your best self, help you uncover your dreams, help you explore what the obstacles are to creating success, and then creating action plans and action steps to go off and really make those dreams happen. So that's what my book is about. It's about the 10 areas of creative life that you need to master in order to be successful, and how to go about mastering each of those areas.
That's phenomenal. And so, also, it's obviously not just limited to music. I mean, it's any creative.
Not at all. Well, you know, it's interesting, because when I started coaching, because I'm a lawyer, I actually thought that my niche would be frustrated creative lawyers like me, you know, coach myself, right? And I actually had a few of those, but again, I resonated much more with the musicians. And then I started attracting other creative people. So I've had graphic designers and writers and people in the theater. And I also spend a lot of time working with arts executives. Many of whom were trained as singers and as artists. Mm-hmm. And it all resonates, and it all is the same message, because I think creative people do share that impulse, but they're always looking for that new thing that they can say, whether it's through song, dance, you know, composition, performance, whatever it is, and words, spoken words. So mm-hmm. I think it works. So the working title is Coaching Creative Success. That will probably change, but that's really what I'm all about. And I think the coaching piece is really important, because coaches don't tell people what to do, right? We have our mothers to tell us what to do. You don't need me. It's true, right? But instead, to help you tap into your inner wisdom. You know, when I first started coaching, I thought, really? And then the more I coach, the more I realize that when you help people discover what it is that they really want, then you have incredible motivation, because that's really what coaching is. It's a motivational tool to help you. It's self-exploration, but also coaching is all about results, right? Set a goal, figure out what's getting in the way of the goals, set an action plan, commit to your actions, do them, learn from your mistakes, keep going, right? It's a whole process. So anyway, so my book is going to be very coachy, with every chapter having coaching tips and workbooks. And I love to create worksheets. So you'll have a ton of worksheets that go along with this to help you really implement all the things that I'm helping you to do. Why am I doing this? Because I want all creative people to be able to live from their creativity and offer their wonderful ideas to the world. I think it just enriches the world. And it's exciting for me to see what creative people can do. It's amazing. I love that.
It's phenomenal. Well, I am very excited to read it when it's finished.
Thank you. You know, actually, I'm going to be sharing it on social media.
Excellent.
So I'm going to be, you know, I want to crowdsource this baby because I think it'll be fun for me.
Good.
To see what resonates. Yes,
yep.
I think that'll be part of my package.
Well, tell people how they can kind of follow along and, you know, how to reach you, where the blog is. Can you let people know all that?
Sure. Absolutely. So my website is just my name, AstridBaumgartner.com. My blog is right on the first page of my website.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also on Facebook under my name. I'm also on Twitter. It's at A Baumgartner. So far, that's it. I probably will start Instagramming when I have more content. I'll start sharing on Instagram, but I will start with Twitter and Facebook.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I am so happy that we finally were able to connect and we could have this discussion because I think it is so important. I really do. For artists
Thank
of
you.
All kinds, for musicians of all stripes, I really do think that this is so essential. So I'm really grateful that you could join us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity because I'm eager to connect with musicians and artists of all stripes. So all of you audience people out there, I'd love to get to know you. You know, just find me on Facebook or Twitter, read my blog, send me an email. My contact information is right on my website. And yeah, just keep doing it, people. Have those ideas and put them out there. That's my final message to everybody.
Amen. Amen, amen. Another phenomenal interview. I'm sure you all agree. So again, to keep in touch with Astrid, to find out more about her book, read her blog, find out more about her phenomenal coaching, go to AstridBaumgartner.com. Do a Google search for her name to follow her on social media. And I'm sure you will be richly rewarded, as I have, in terms of all of her incredible knowledge and wisdom and inspiration. So again, thus ends another week, another amazing episode of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel. Just wanted to give you guys a little bit of a heads up. We did post a blog all about fall internships. I'm sure you've heard many of my guests talk about their first experience in the music industry was an internship, their first opportunity, getting a foot in the door, networking. So it can really be a crucial part of your music career trajectory. I posted whatever I basically saw on social media. So there's fall internships for New York, for Los Angeles. I think there's a couple for Nashville, and I will keep updating as I see them. Again, I'm just sort of passing on what I've seen on social media for fall internships in the music industry. So I just want to help you guys out. So again, you can just go to musicjobspodcast.com and check out that blog or share it or forward it to somebody who you know is looking for a music internship. Okay, guys, also just wanted to give another shout out. I had an EP drop last month called Diatribe that you can listen to on all the streaming platforms, on Spotify, Tidal, Apple Music, etc. It was a collaboration that I did with Sound Control, an amazing producer. So I hope you can check it out and tell me what you think. I'm on social media at L-A-R-I-E-L Music, or you know my website, lariel-music.com. Okay, my loves, so take care. Have a wonderful, productive, amazing week. And remember to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.